This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. Good afternoon, I'm Bill Hammack. On today's show, we're looking at the career of Orson Welles. Now, the commonplace view of Welles is that he created the great classic Citizen Kane and then lived a life of failed promise and squandered talent, ending his career as spokesman for a California winery and as the butt of fat jokes by Johnny Carson. Today, though, I'll talk with an actor and an author who nuances this narrative arc and even argues that some of Welles' best work came after Citizen Kane. Let's welcome to the Afternoon Magazine Simon Callow.
Hi. Hello.
Simon, you called the life of Welles after Kane one of sustained falling apart.
And yes.
In fact, in this hour, what I want to do is to look at the details of that falling apart.
And yes.
The texture, if you will, of Welles' career after Kane.
Yes.
Now, your second volume begins in 1941, just as Citizen Kane is released by RKO Pictures. Today we know, you know, that it's hailed as a masterpiece, but what was the critical and popular perception at the time?
There were two very different things. That is to say, the critical perception was ecstatic. He couldn't possibly have had better notices. They mostly acclaimed him as the greatest filmmaker who'd ever lived, and Kane as the greatest film ever made. But that ecstatic acclaim was not by any means reflected at the box office. He was, in fact, the film outside of New York and Los Angeles was regarded as box office poison by the distributors. And I don't think we should feel too condescending towards the people of the time. It is a very radical film. And people obviously preferred straight narrative. And they liked to believe in the characters that they were watching. And, of course, Welles' whole brilliance in the film is to diffract the narrative as much as possible and to make you constantly aware in a sort of Brechtian way of the film as a film. You're never allowed to forget that it's a movie all the time, which is, of course, the thing that has excited everybody ever since about Kane and excited the critics at the time, is that you're a participant somehow in the making of the film, which was a very Wellesian sort of ploy. But it didn't appeal to America in general at all. So Welles already started his career with a problem, which is that RKO was not making any money out of him, having spent a great deal on him.
Mm-hmm. And what financial straits was RKO in at the time?
It was getting a little wobbly, actually. Mm-hmm. A number of its most hyped films had not done very well at the box office. And so they knew, that is to say, George Schaefer, who was the head of RKO, who had in fact presided over a period of some success in the years just before Kane, was in a slightly more dubious position. But the European market, you see, had closed up because of the war. From 1939, they didn't have their European market, which was absolutely a vital part of their bookkeeping. And so it was all the more important that Welles should be able to turn out a very popular film. And they tried, he and George Schaefer, who was very much his champion, who was the man who had brought him to Los Angeles, mm-hmm. and who had saved him, had protected him from the hellhounds that William Randolph Hearst had tried to unleash in order to get the film suppressed. Citizen Kane suppressed. Schaefer had absolutely stood by Welles, but he said to him, "Now, Orson, you and I both know we don't want to make another politically controversial film. What we want to do is to make a film that will appeal to everybody." And so they set about trying to find that film. And it took them, just as it had taken Welles some long time to find the subject for Kane, it took him quite a long time to find his next subject. And they worked actively on a couple of thrillers, which was a genre that Welles was very fascinated mm-hmm. by. But they were rather controversial because they were all set in Europe or South America in a war kind of a context. And eventually Welles hit on a favorite old novel of his, which he'd already done on the radio, which was Booth Tarkington's Indiana epic, his Hoosier epic, his Midlands epic, mm-hmm. the Magnificent Ambersons. And that seemed absolutely ideal. It was a classic, it was a period piece of some beauty and charm and dignity, and they went ahead with it. And they started shooting it in the the fall of 1941.
Now, you mentioned this film, but at the same time, he was also working on a show or a movie called It's All True, wasn't he?
Yes, he was beginning to plan. Well, the truth of the matter is that he was planning simultaneously anything up to 20 films, and he was optioning films, optioning books left, right, and center. At one point, he had 100 books optioned for possible production by just, you know, this one unit within RKO. That was three times as many as anybody else had within RKO, and included Mein Kampf. I don't think they optioned that, but certainly that was one of the possible subjects, and The Life of Christ was another. So he was spreading his net pretty wide. But he had come up with this idea, which is always dear to his heart, and very typical of his experimental ambitions, of making a film which was a compendium of short films, in the same way that you might, for example, have a collection of short stories, or more, as he put it at the time, like a kind of magazine, the film as magazine, which was going to be called It's All True, because all of the stories were going to be somehow based on real events. And so to that end, he optioned, for example, a short story written by John Fante about his own family. And they were going to do a film called Bonito the Bull, which was from a short story by Robert Flaherty about apparently a real story about a boy and his relationship with this bull in Mexico.
So this was one of the four or five stories that would have been in the movie It's All True.
That's correct. And another was going to be the story of jazz. She was very fascinated by Wells, and Duke Ellington was going to write the score and possibly also write the screenplay with Wells. And it might have been Ellington's life story, or it might not have been. Everything was open for discussion, but it was a compendious kind of a project. You could have put anything in or taken anything out.
Now you called it characteristic Wells, and you said it was a mix of political idealism, artistic excitement, and calculating self-promotion.
Yeah.
And how did it fit into that, particularly political idealism?
Well, because for example, the John Fante story was a kind of idealization of a working class love affair. The Bonito the Bull was a sort of folk story of Mexican origin. The jazz story was a sort of radicalism on Wells's part, politically speaking, because he wanted to draw attention to music of the black community, you know, mm-hmm. which is how he saw jazz as essentially a manifestation of black culture. None of it was head-on political propaganda, but it all came from what you might call Wells's broad sympathy with something called the Popular Front.
Can you describe the Popular Front?
Well, the Popular Front was a loose grouping of non-Marxist radicals, essentially. People who believed their essential political program, and it included many, many very distinguished artists, filmmakers, painters. Chaplin, for example, was within the embrace of the political front, the Popular Front, and they were essentially they were pro-union, they were anti-imperialist, particularly British imperialist, but any kind of imperialism, and especially latent American imperialism, which they all feared was very much on the horizon, and then most prominently they were they were anti-racist, and above all anti-lynching. And I suppose it's a little bit of a surprise to us now to think that in 1941-42 there were still many states which did not have anti-lynching legislation, mm-hmm. and they were very much in favor of promoting that. Well, no, none of that, none of the pro-union or the anti-imperialist or the anti-lynching platform was in It's All True. It wasn't that sort of a movie. It was regarded as a much lighter kind of a movie than
that. But somehow it fit into the artistic ideals of this Popular Front in a broad way.
Yes.
But
exactly.
What happened to it? What happened with Wells in Brazil, where he was shooting?
Ah, well, that's another story, and you need to bear in mind that something fantastically significant for America happened while Wells was just coming to the end of shooting the Magnificent Ambersons, and that, of course, was Pearl Harbor.
Mm-hmm.
And I've said kind of semi-humorously that the Second World War was a bit of a disaster for mankind in general, but very particularly it was a disaster for Orson Welles, because the moment that war was declared, Welles was very, very anxious. Having the Popular Front, I may say, having had two minds about whether America should participate in what they thought was possibly an imperialist war, the Second World War, especially from the British point of view, they'd modified their view and tended to throw in their lot with Roosevelt on this matter. And Roosevelt, of course, was very keen for America to join the war. And so Welles was keen also to make a contribution. And he'd always failed his call-up, military call-up, because of asthma and flat feet and a scoliotic spine. I'm not altogether convinced that he really wanted to enlist, but anyway, mm-hmm. he couldn't, even if he had wanted to. But so he offered himself, or wanted to be and somehow put to work on behalf of the Allied cause. And that came very quickly. Nelson Rockefeller was the head of the Inter-American Affairs Committee, which was essentially concerned with trying to get the South American countries on the side of the Allies, because America dreaded having an enemy in its back door. And so they were doing everything they could to encourage relations with those countries and to push them away from the Axis and towards the Allies. And the contribution they wanted Hollywood to make was a very simple one. They wanted someone to go and make a film in Rio de Janeiro. The carnival was just coming up in February of 1942. And they wanted somebody to make a movie which showed how what a gorgeous country Brazil was, what an enchanting phenomenon the carnival in Rio was, and how much it was endorsed by America. Excuse me. And so they came to Welles, who was, of course, the great flamboyant genius of the moment, and said, "Will you go to Rio, film the carnival, make some kind of a quick but very colorful and brilliant film, and come back, and then carry on editing the Magnificent Ambersons." And that was the plan. And what happened, though, was that Welles, when he went to Brazil, fell in love with Brazilian culture, with Rio, and with all the available sensual delights. And they were many, and most of them in fleshly form. And he was plunged into, like a small boy in a sweet shop, into all the delights available to him, which suddenly put the whole agenda why he was there into some difficulty. He was most certainly determined to make a film there, but he wasn't clear what sort of a film it was, and he wanted to know more about Brazilian culture.
Did he even have a script that he was shooting for?
Not really. Mm-hmm. Not really. The brief, above all, was to shoot the carnival. And they did, which was an extraordinary undertaking for someone who'd only made one film, and that very much a studio film under extremely controlled circumstances.
So he was really trying to break out of the studio film with this It's All True, the Brazilian film.
Eventually, yes, he saw that as a possibility. That wasn't what they... I must stress that when they went out to mm-hmm. Brazil, the purpose was to make this propaganda film, essentially propaganda film. And it was only typical of Welles that as soon as he started reading and getting all his people to read for him and bring him briefs and digests of Brazilian history and indeed the whole of South American history, and of course being who he was, being having the kind of intellectual appetite that he did, he fell in love with all the possibilities of this and then started to think of making It's All True not the compendium that he'd thought of, but more of a South American compendium. And he started thinking about doing not only the carnival story, but also, which had been suggested to him by the Brazilian authorities, the story of some rafters, fishermen from the north of Brazil, who'd taken their little barks, which are called jangadas, little rafts, down to... They'd taken themselves all the way down the side of the coast, which was a monumental journey to take on a raft like that, to present a petition to the president, asking him to allow them to become unionized, and the president had said yes, and they wanted to film this as an example of what a fine country Brazil was. But Welles became fascinated by something else, which was the samba and the origins of the samba, and he saw that, which is evident to anybody, that the samba is an African dance in origin, and that its main source in Brazil, in Rio, was the favelas, which are the slums in Rio, and so Wells started to shoot that. And the authorities and the American contingent, both on the set and back home, were absolutely appalled, because this meant putting black people on the screen, possibly in conjunction with white people, which meant that the film would be unsellable below the Mason-Dixon line. Mm-hmm. And they were already beginning to get anxious as to what kind of a film was Wells trying to make. And it was quite unclear to everybody, even on the set, and even to Wells. He just didn't know, frankly, and sometimes took days and even weeks off just to think about it, or to make speeches about something, or to continue his investigations of some very attractive young woman that he'd just met. And the film started to become an amorphous enigma. Nobody knew at all what was going on.
So there was never any result from this. All we have are, what, clips of the carnival at Rio? I mean...
No. We have better than that, much better than that. And we have various attempts by Wells' team, particularly, to find a framework which would accommodate all this material. But it was an ever-expanding framework, because at one point Wells thought how interesting it would be to show, for example, the conquest of the Andes. I think, you know, he saw that as a short film, but there was no limit to what could be done in his view. But what really then happened, of course, was that RKO began to get very frightened, and they said, "Look, you're running up huge bills. We don't have any money at all. We're in real trouble now financially. Please stop all shooting now." And Wells just ignored them completely. Eventually, they called back the team to America, and Wells was left with a tiny core team. And he went up north to Fortaleza and filmed the beginning of the story of the fishermen going down to Rio. And that footage remains and has been edited into a coherent whole. I'm sure Wells would have done more with it, but into a coherent whole, which I would say ranks among the most beautiful film that Wells ever made, and possibly some of the most beautiful film sequences of the 20th century.
Now, is that available to...
Yes, you can get that on a DVD called It's All True.
You can.
And it is quite astonishing what he did with one camera, one cameraman, no artificial light at all, no actors, no professional actors.
Mm-hmm.
He did something of such purity and simplicity, but also of such artistic ambition. You actually do see, I think, in those sequences, that Wells was what was so often said of him, a genius. Mm-hmm. I think that is the work of a potential genius in film. Not very much of the rest of his work has the quality of that film, because, or that footage, I should say, because mostly because Wells had, you know, more interesting technology at his disposal normally, which he wanted to exploit.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, he wasn't as living in such a simple way as he was. He was away from everything that he normally liked to indulge in and engage in. And so something quite remarkable comes out of that. However, the point is that by that stage, the Magnificent Amazons had, where Wells had been trying to edit it by remote control, which is a very dodgy prospect under any circumstances.
You mentioned that he met with Robert Wise,
met with Robert Wise in Miami.
Yes.
On his way to Rio.
And they discussed the editing of
the Amazons? They discussed the editing of the film. Wells gave him very good, clear instructions about what was to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And Wise went away and did it. Did exactly what Wells had asked him to do. But what happened then was that, as you go on editing a film, you in the post-production process throws up many questions and many decisions have to be made. But if the director's not there to make them, then somebody else will make them.
So describe to us maybe a little bit, he's left to Brazil to do It's All True. He's left the Magnificent Ambersons in a rough cut.
Yeah.
And what is a rough cut?
Well, a rough cut essentially is what you hope is going to be in the film. it's your statement as a director and an editor of what the shape of the film will be. As I say, the material that will be included. And the next stage is to do post-production, which is to bring the sound and the music and possibly special effects or indeed pickup shots and so on. You may find, having looked at your rough cut, that there are missing shots, and you have to go and pick them up again, or something in it isn't working, and you have to solve it. On Citizen Kane, I think Wells was editing, post-producing Citizen Kane for something like 4 or 5 months. I can't remember the precise figure, but it was a long time, and he made a great, great deal of the film of Kane with the aid of special effects, the special effects department, which doesn't just mean, you know, dragons and monsters. It means certain sequences, as, for example, the famous sequence in Citizen Kane where Susan Alexander Kane is trying to sing in her opera, and the camera pans up into the flies at the theater, and you see the fly men holding their nose, saying, "This stinks." That actual sequence was put together in special effects.
So in the case of Amberson's, you've noted that he really left the film with all the raw materials in place, but a lot of vital alterations left to be done. In fact, 30% of the Amberson's, you say, was made after the end of principal photography.
Yeah.
And at this time, he was in Brazil.
Yeah.
So what happened to Amberson's without Wells' real controlling hand there?
What happened was that George Schaefer kept on saying, Please, Orson, we need you back here to tighten up the film, because it was very long. This was the everybody admired it very much, but it was very, very long. And eventually they showed it. They did something which they never did for Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane was never shown to preview audiences. It was only shown to journalists who, of course, they wanted to recruit to fight the whole, you know, William Randolph Hearst problem. And what they did with the magnificent Amberson's was to take it to the town of Pomona, a university town mostly, and to show it to their kids' audience. And it was shown with a wartime movie, a very gung-ho wartime movie, and a personal appearance by James Cagney. And the audience just loathed it. It was slow, it was long, it was darkly lit, it was art.
So this was Wells' original cut?
Wells' original cut, exactly. And they reacted in shock, basically, because all the way through the shooting, whenever they'd seen the rushes, the executives from RKO had said to Wells, "This is the most beautiful thing we've ever seen." Of course, what hit them then and there in Pomona was that Wells, that the film, the book, the subject that they had chosen to film was a very depressing one for that moment in American history. The moment when the troops were going for the first time into Europe, when war had been engaged, when the armaments industry was revving itself up, and America was gearing itself for as long a war as it took. Wells was presenting with a story about the decline of American gentry and the rise of the car and its rather baleful effects of industrialization. Well, I mean, America was just about to commit its industry to the biggest challenge it had ever had. So such a film probably, no matter what the circumstances, could never have been a hit in the spring of 1942.
Mm-hmm.
As always happens in these circumstances, suddenly everybody started to find fault with the film. Even the actors, Joe Cotton and so on, said, "Well, you know, you have made it very Chekhovian and very dark and very somber, and we never, you know, meant it to be this kind of film when we were making it. We thought we were making something much more upbeat and fun and so on." And they, the actors of the Mercury Theatre, who had always been very, very close with Wells, Robert Wise, the assistant director, Freddie Fleck, and George Schaefer, and the manager of Wells' unit, Jack Moss, who was a sometime vaudevillian conjurer and now business manager, all set to work on changing the film. And they cut it, and they reshot it, and they re-edited it, one of the greatest shots that Wells ever planned was a continuous shot going through the mansion of the Ambersons. It was going to be one of the longest tracking shots in the history of the cinema, and they wantonly just cut it in three different places so that it no longer had that sweep. And that was a deeply tragic thing to have happened. By now, George Schaefer was anyway losing the battle to run RKO, and he was replaced by a man called Charles Koerner. And Charles Koerner, who was an avowed enemy of Wells and everything that Wells stood for, whose slogan for RKO was showmanship, not genius, insisted that the film be reduced to 93 minutes or whatever it was, so as it could be part of a double bill. And it was in that form that it was finally released without any premiere at all on a loopy, a double bill with a loopy Velez vehicle, and got a sort of moderate amount of attention from the press, but everybody was A, baffled by why this film now, and B, found it to be not as as somehow as skillful as Citizen Kane, which I think was probably true.
So when we look at the Magnificent Ambersons today, are we actually seeing a fair percentage of that film that was not actually shot by Wells was reshot?
Not an enormous percentage. Okay. What you're seeing is what you're not seeing what Wells shot, rather than you're seeing stuff that he didn't shoot. There are a couple of sequences at the end, particularly, where instead of Wells's scripted and indeed shot scene, which was invented by Wells, the only thing really in the movie that Wells invented, is because it's a very faithful adaptation, mm-hmm. essentially, of the novel. But at the end of it, he had Agnes Moorehead and and Tim Holt in a kind of a almost a like a retirement home, and Joe Cotton visiting them, and it being a very somber and slightly crazy scene. Well, they replaced that completely with Uplift, which is exactly how the novel ends, as it happens. So they had a sort of justification for it, of Joe Cotton, you know, walking off into the sunset with his daughter, and everything having been solved and resolved, and with Bernard Herrmann's great score replaced in that part of the film by a dreary, generic score by a man called Roy Webb.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I'm talking with Simon Callow, author of a multi-volume biography of Orson Welles, and the second volume, Hello Americans, has been published recently. Now, soon after this period where he's making Magnificent Ambersons, he's working on It's All True, and we didn't even talk about Journey into Fear, which he was also making, three
yep.
separate projects at the same time.
Yes.
Soon after this period, though, he tried for several years to reinvent himself. I mean, he attempted to be, and this was very odd to me. I didn't know this. He was trying to be a Fred Allen, Jack Benny-style comedian, a liberal orator, and a political columnist.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about his attempts to be a comedian?
Yes. I mean, Wells was always adored comedy. I don't know that he had a great gift for it, unfortunately, but he was a sufficiently ebullient and jolly companion that his friend Jack Benny... He'd met Benny in New York, and they'd got on very, very well indeed. And when Jack Benny, who you must remember was absolutely the greatest radio star of the day and one of the greatest comedians of the 20th century, fell ill, they got Wells to replace him for a number of programs. And he sort of did valiantly, but it wasn't funny, really, at all, and certainly it wasn't Jack Benny. And... But Wells, nonetheless, and certain executives had the idea that he could be funny if only they found the right kind of persona for him. And so they gave him a show called Orson Welles' Almanac, in which he tried to become a comedian. And it was woeful, really, and very sad to read the correspondence between him and his executives, where they say, you know, Orson... this isn't funny. And him saying, yes, it is funny. You just haven't quite seen it properly. But I promise you, oh, my word, this is funny. And there's nothing sadder than that, really. And eventually, of course, the program was just dropped. He loved vaudeville. He loved everything to do with the popular theater.
But he actually made a study of comedians in a way. If I read your book correctly, he discussed how Jack Benny was funny and how Fred Allen was funny, and noted he had to be more like Fred Allen. I mean, what was he thinking? What was his conclusion to be more like Fred Allen? I can't think of anything more different than.
I know it does seem a bit delusional, doesn't it? But what he was what he meant by that was that he was more of a reactive comedian. Jack Benny had such an advanced persona, you know, everybody knew exactly who Jack Benny was. That was the glory of the radio program, is that in his pauses, in his masterly, famous, long pauses, you as the radio listener could imagine his face. Of course, that was never going to be the case with Wells. So they tried to constructed a persona for him of this irascible genius. Which was sort of somewhat close, rather too close to the truth in a way, because, Jack Benny's persona was a totally invented one. Jack Benny was a very generous man, and the whole key to Jack Benny's persona was that he was mean. Jack Benny played the violin rather well, and the whole idea was that he couldn't play the violin, and so on. Whereas this sort of extension of Wells was an uncomfortable... It was hard to know what was really supposed to be funny about it. Wells carried on his meditations on comics and comedians right to the end of his life. In the 70s, he made a film with some of the young English comics of the period, not the Monty Python lot, another lot who had a program called I'm Sorry, I'll Read That Again. And he dressed up as a landlady or a policeman in another sketch. He really did love it, but as I'm afraid I have to report, he didn't seem to have a great gift for it.
Now, something that came through in your book that he seemed gifted for was as a political columnist and kind of a liberal orator. Tell us a little bit about what his politics were like at the time. What kind of causes did he espouse?
Much the same ones that I described earlier, which is to say, essentially, he was very much pro-union. Quite unexpectedly, thoroughly pro-union. I mean, he really did support the Teamsters, all the small industry unions could expect to get a good puff from Wells. The main plank of his platform was his anti-racism, and that he wrote about most eloquently and spoke about most eloquently. And he was very concerned, I repeat again, with the drift of American policy. Especially he was concerned, became increasingly concerned over the early 40s, with how America would handle itself after the war, when it became increasingly clear that the war was going to be won, and won, you know, sooner rather than later. The big question was, if America emerged the victor from the war, which is essentially the person that was emerging, the country that was emerging from the war, how would it handle its power in the world? How would it behave? And Wells very, very much wanted to promote internationalism.
So, but he did this, did he not, as a columnist for, what was it, the New York Post?
Yes, he did. I mean... one needs to separate his political activities a little. On the one hand, he was an orator, as you said, giving quite substantial speeches in very, very large stadiums, like the Lewis Owen Stadium in New York, other great stadia in Chicago, Boston, elsewhere, mostly to what you might call popular front audiences, you know, liberal audiences. And some of these speeches were so admired at the time that they were turned into pamphlets and quoted from, and he gave, as all orators do, the same speech over and over again in different cities, was a real cheerleader for the radical and the liberal positions. This he did, sometimes he did for money, but quite often he did it simply gratis and because of his passion for the cause. The column was a slightly different thing. The column was also called Orson Welles' Almanac in the New York Post, and it purported to be, as the name suggests, a sort of astrology section, a little bit of gossip, a little bit of political analysis, whatever came to view, who was born on this day, a recipe for healing bunions, whatever. That was the conceit of it. But Wells was clearly not really interested in any of the more popular elements of it. What he was interested in was making his political points. He became increasingly driven politically. He felt a sort of tremendous sense of urgency about what he was saying, how important it was that people should grasp what was happening in the world and try to influence it favorably. This, of course, was absolutely not what the readers of the New York Post wanted, or may I more precisely say, not what they wanted from Orson Welles. What they wanted and what the people who ran the New York Post wanted from Orson Welles was basically a sort of high-class showbiz gossip. And at the very occasion, he would provide that for them. But he wrote the column for nearly 2 years. But the crucial sort of support system of that column was the syndicate of newspapers around America, which would take the column, and very quickly, one by one, they started canceling their subscription to Wells. And so eventually he was just writing for the New York Post, was making almost no money from it at all, and spending a great deal of money on a little army of researchers.
Well, one of the very interesting things you do in the book is you reprint large chunks of these speeches, essays, and columns, really showing his genius in this series. Was that a surprise to you? Did you know about this before you started the book?
I knew about it, but it isn't until you really look at the specific pieces in question that you begin to see how substantial a political thinker he was. I mean, he wasn't an original political thinker. I think that it's quite important to say that. But he did articulate the positions that he stood for very cleverly, very brilliantly. He was especially good at writing in what you might call parables or fables, exemplary tales about certain kinds of behavior, and always at his best writing about racism. He had this is partly from his childhood. His mother was an extremely left-wing figure too, and all his life Wells just loved the black culture, had many close black friends, and believed with a kind of almost hysterical intensity that terrible, terrible injustice was constantly being done to the black community. And in a later radio program, which is called Orson Welles Commentaries, which was for a very small audience, it was a sort of, you might call it now, a blog, you know. It was just Welles talking directly to the audience about his political views. He did a very major service in the NAACP, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored Peoples, had come to him and said, look, we've discovered this terrible injustice that a returning black veteran has been blinded by police in the South, and we don't know who did it.
And that veteran was an African American, right?
He was indeed, yes. Yeah. This is in 1946, and the man's name was Isaac Woodard, and the NAACP wanted to make a big issue of it, and they enlisted Wells, and Wells, in a series of broadcasts, bring the problem, this man's situation, very much to the fore. But it's quite interesting how sort of hysterical he became in denouncing the man he called Officer X, the man whose name, and saying, we will hound you, we will find you wherever you are. I have my agents. I will find you. And you began to think, who exactly is this person that's talking? Is it Wells, or is it the Shadow, or who? It begins to unbalance somewhat, and you start to think that what matters is less what Isaac Woodard had gone through and more what Wells was feeling. And there is a certain oddity in this area of Wells's political convictions. A kind of hysteria is the only way I can quite describe it. It may explain why he didn't really pursue the political career that he was toying with at the time. There were two kind of areas in which he might have stood for Congress. That was an idea. Another idea was that he might have tried to become the governor of a state. Mm-hmm. And the third idea, very much promoted by his political mentor, a man called Louis Dolivet, who Wells and everybody else thought to be a French hero of the resistance, but in fact was a Romanian Marxist apparatchik who had indeed fought in the French resistance. But this man had come to America and married Beatrice Whitney Strait, and was promoting something that he called the free world. And it was he, Dolivet, who had the idea that Orson Welles should be groomed to be, if not the first, then a very early Secretary General of the United Nations, which was just about to be formed, do you know? And so Welles was, I mean, this was pretty serious stuff. He became part of Roosevelt's campaign team to re-elect Roosevelt for the fourth time. And when Roosevelt died, it was Welles who made the oration on the radio, a very powerful and moving elegy for Roosevelt and what was lost with Roosevelt. And, of course, it wasn't just the man that Welles was lamenting. He knew who was going to follow him. In other words, the vice president, Harry S. Truman, who was the epitome of everything that Welles hated. Though he was now the head of the party that Welles supported, he detested Harry Truman's policies, and you know, especially the Cold War policies and the bomb and all the rest of it, and felt that America had completely failed in the mission that it might have had, which was to lead the way for international cooperation. And Welles held America very much to blame, though he wasn't at all dewy-eyed about Stalin either, but he really felt that America had had the initiative and had failed it and had gone back to its old self-interests, you know?
Simon, we have about 2 or 3 minutes left here, and I want to move to the end of your biography, which ends in 1947 when Welles has just finished Macbeth. And he leaves America before even post-production of Macbeth. Why did he leave, and what did it really mean for him, do you think, to leave America and be in exile for some 20, 25 years?
Nearly 20 years, and he did come back a few times, but there's no question about it that he washed his hands, or as you might say, he brushed the dust of America off his feet when he left in 47. I think it's very largely to do with this political despair that I've just described. I think why I call the book Hello Americans, which is the title of one of his radio programs of the period, is that I think he was trying to address America for all those years from 42 to 47. He was in various forms, through American popular forms like radio comedy, vaudeville, extravaganza, which he did in Around the World. In the subjects of his films, he was always dealing with the question of what is it to be an American? What is the responsibility of being an American? How should we as Americans live our lives? What are our responsibilities in the world? What are our responsibilities towards each other? And I think that he felt that after 5 years of passionately addressing these questions, no one was listening. And I think he went because of that. There's a small issue of a tax problem, but it would easily have been resolved. At one point, the IRS said, look, give us $1,000 and we'll write it all off. And he could easily have found that $1,000. He didn't, as it happens, and indeed he did continue to have problems, but I don't think that's why he left America. He left America then because, for the reason I've just given, and for another, which was I think he finally understood that he could no longer function in the Hollywood system at all. He realized at last what he absolutely was, which was an independent and a maverick and an experimental filmmaker. He would never be part of the mainstream, and he never actually has been. Even Citizen Kane is not part of the mainstream of cinema yet. It is for the conoscenti, it is for, you know, the editors of film magazines and so on, but it's still not a film that people absolutely take to their heart, the bulk of the viewing audience.
Well, Simon, on that note, we'll have to look forward to your third volume, and perhaps fourth of Orson Welles. So, Simon, thanks for taking the time to chat.
Thank you, Bill.
I'm Bill Hammack, and I've been talking with Simon Callow, author of a biography of Orson Welles entitled Hello, Americans.